On the 23rd day of Fishmas, the Fisheries Podcast gave to me an interview with Katie O'Reilly, talking about the work she's doing on her PhD and some Fishmas history. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you are on Twitter, then you have most likely come across our guest for this week, Katie O'Reilly. Katie is a PhD candidate in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Notre Dame. Her research focuses on coastal ecology of Lake Michigan, with an emphasis on coastal wetland habitats and the fish that inhabit them. Katie is a prolific member of the Twitter SciComm community as Dr. Catfish, where she uses social media to communicate ecological issues. During 2018, Katie has been participating in the Knaus Marine Policy Fellowship in Washington, D.C., where she serves as a science communications specialist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Sea Grant Program. During her fellowship, she has learned about communicating science from a federal agency and made connections across the government, nonprofit, and academic worlds. Katie sees the ability to communicate science as an important addition to every scientist's skill set that benefits individuals of all career stages and breaks down barriers between research and the real world. Welcome to the podcast, Katie.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nick, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
No problem. You were on my short list when I first started the podcast of guests, and a special Christmas episode. This one comes out on December 23rd. I thought, who better than the creator of Fishmas herself?
Exactly. It's very seasonal, very seasonally appropriate.
All right. So your bio left off the early years of a younger Katie. How did you become interested in the field of fisheries?
That's a great question. I grew up in Northwest Ohio, kind of on the shores of Western Lake Erie. And I just remember going to the beach. And it was back then that Lake Erie had, you know, a lot of ecological challenges. And I remember being on the beach and having like pea soup green water roll up and thinking, something seems wrong here. But at the same time, I didn't really know you could study like freshwater ecosystems. I grew up with a bunch of ocean documentaries, so like National Geographic videos. And I was always really, really amazed and entranced by those. So at first I thought like, oh, you know, there's ocean scientists. And it wasn't until I got, you know, older and probably a little wiser that I realized I could become a freshwater scientist who studied fishes. And that led to the path that I'm currently on today.
All right. So you're currently a PhD candidate at Notre Dame. Tell us a little bit about the research you're doing there with coastal wetlands.
Yeah, so as part of my dissertation work at Notre Dame, I am interested in understanding kind of the food webs of coastal wetlands and the Great Lakes. So the Great Lakes, the word lakes is deceiving. They actually function a lot like inland oceans. And the coastal wetlands are no exception. They function a lot like salt marshes in the marine ecosystems, and that they're really important habitat for juvenile fish. They are an area where fish spawn. They provide food, refuge, foraging, for basically, you know, everything a growing fish would need. They're the perfect habitat. But we've lost a lot of the coastal wetlands that surround the Great Lakes to land development. So my work is looking at how we can quantify the importance of the wetlands to supporting lake food webs. And I do that in a couple of different ways. I look at stable isotope analysis, which allows us to look at the flow of energy between the coastal wetland food webs and the open water of the lake through fish movement. Say, you know, a baby fish grows up in the coastal wetland, consumes a lot of resources there, and then moves to the offshore of the lake into more of the pelagic environment. It's transferring that energy from the coastal wetland to the near shore. And so my work is looking at how we can quantify that. And then I'm also addressing this question through otolith microchemistry, looking at the trace elements that get incorporated into otoliths as a fish grows, and looking at how that chemistry varies between the coastal wetland habitats and the nearshore can give us kind of a record of where a fish has spent its time.
A few of the people I've interviewed in the past have talked about microchemistry, but the stable isotope analysis might be new to some people. What exactly does that involve?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So isotopes are basically, you know, within elements, isotopes have different neutrons. And what that all means for application purposes is I'm looking at how these isotopes vary between different habitats. So we use carbon and nitrogen stable isotopes to look at how energy in the wetland, which has a very distinct isotope signature because of processes such as decomposition and carbon cycling. It has this unique isotope signature that we see in some of the primary production going into higher trophic levels, such as macroinvertebrates. That signature gets retained, and we can trace that energy then by sampling the isotopes of higher level consumers, things like fish that move and use multiple different habitats.
So then how far along the PhD progress meter are you? Are you close to the finish? Or are you still collecting data? Or?
I would knock on wood. I'm hopefully closer to the end of the process. I passed my candidacy exam, so I am a PhD candidate. And now I'm mostly in the data analysis and writing stages of the PhD.
I'm sure your progress was slowed with your recent little hiatus. You spent the last year as a Canals Marine Policy Fellow in Washington, D.C. I guess, firstly, what is this fellowship and what was that experience like?
The Canals Fellowship is run by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Within NOAA, there's the National Sea Grant College Program, probably better known to most people as Sea Grant. And they run this fellowship for master's, JD, and PhD students that is basically an experience working in a government setting at the federal level for a year to better understand how science is actually used, incorporated into the policymaking process. So for my Canals Fellowship, I have been working in the National Sea Grant Office. I do science communication professionally, actually, which is kind of fun for me as someone who does not have a formal communications background. So what I've been able to do this year is I take the work that's happening all across the 33 Sea Grant programs that are across the United States, and I help the researchers tell their story, say, you know, why their research is important, and help better communicate that to a whole bunch of diverse audiences, everything from, you know, a senator on Capitol Hill to a lobster fisherman in the Gulf of Maine. And so that's been really rewarding for me to learn how to communicate science better myself, as well as how do I work with other researchers to help them communicate their science and help them identify the key messages they want to convey when they're speaking to any number of different audiences who are coming at these issues with very different perspectives and kind of context.
So you mentioned that was kind of a new experience in science communication, but long before that, you were on Twitter, and anyone that's on Twitter most likely has seen tweets by Dr. Catfish popping up. When did you start using social media to promote fishery science?
I first joined Twitter in 2014, which was actually prompted by an experience I'd had in grad school. My graduate program offered a short course in communicating science to media with more of a focus on communicating science to journalists, to TV reporters. But there was a portion of that day that had been devoted to, like, oh, here's social media. This is a tool that you can use. And one thing that really stuck with me then was, you know, they encouraged us to take control of our brand, our identity on social media, saying that you're going to be out there, and like in this internet age, your name is out there as, this is Katie O'Reilly. She's a graduate student at the University of Notre Dame. But to actually have an online identity, to have an online presence that you could have best reflect you and kind of put your science and who you are out there in a way that you wanted to, rather than having, you know, maybe less of a control over your kind of online identity. That kind of prompted me back in 2014 to create a Twitter. And like any new Twitter user, it's super overwhelming when you first, you know, get there. You're like, oh my gosh, how am I supposed to find anything? And it did take me some time to just figure out, okay, who are the people I want to be following? You know, what's the point of me having this Twitter or this social media presence? What do I want to accomplish? And I wouldn't say I actually figured that out myself until probably, you know, a good year and a half later. It took me that much time to just identify what social media was. And so one of the things I try and help other scientists do is not have that long, sharp learning curve that I did, and help them better use social media effectively as a tool.
Are you on any other social media platforms? For me, I've kind of noticed Twitter is where most of the fish people hang out, but that might just be where I spend most of my time. Are you on any other platforms?
I am on other platforms as a personal choice. I don't really do much in the way of fishery science on other platforms, things like Instagram, Facebook. And again, I'm in a similar boat as you. I'm not sure if I just think like, oh, everyone's on Twitter because I'm spend most of my time on Twitter. I think what's unique about Twitter is the concise messages that it makes you send, and that helps like have very short, like, oh, this is a brand new paper, it's right here. With Instagram, I think it's an awesome tool, and I think it's something that I haven't explored a lot. That there are some scientists on Instagram who are doing some really cool communications, and it's definitely more of a visual social media platform to be used. I'm reluctant to say Facebook is a great tool. I know a lot of people are on it, but it's starting to, at least in a lot of cases, people are moving away from Facebook towards other platforms. One of the things I always encourage people to do is think about, who are you trying to talk to? Are you trying to talk to other scientists? Are you trying to talk to, you know, a local angling club? And figure out where your audience is and use the platform that they're using. Go to where they are. But there, you're right. There's definitely a huge fish sci community on Twitter, which is nice because you can just easily tap into that and get connected and get to be a part of that network pretty easily.
And like you said, there's a big network of fishery professionals on Twitter, and you're definitely one of the more vocal ones, or at least across my Twitter feed, your tweets pop up or your retweets pop up a lot more frequently than others. And so, and this time of year, it's kind of hard to miss the 25 days of Fishmas. And you started that a few years ago, but how did that idea come about?
What is 25 Days of Fishmas? A couple of years ago, back in 2016, I had been scrolling around, you know, I think I was doing some research as part of, you know, my dissertation on Great Lakes wetlands, and I stumbled upon this poster that Wisconsin Sea Grant had, you know, created and promoted, which was a Fishes of the Great Lakes poster. And it basically just, you know, typical wall hanging poster, had a bunch of different fish on it with species names. But for some reason, my brain seeing that thought, oh, you know what this reminds me of? An advent calendar. So in terms of an advent calendar, it's basically the countdown to Christmas. So each day in December leading up to December 25th, you open a little door and typically get some kind of treat or present. But only I thought, oh, no advent calendar. Instead of getting a candy treat, you get some fish facts when you open the little door. And so the first year I really kind of just jumped into it. I didn't have it very well planned out before. I'm just like, oh, it's really cool. I'll just feature a fish each day in December. And for some reason, it really seemed to catch on. It got really popular really quick. There were a lot of people who joined the effort, who helped me through sharing their own perspectives, their own stories. And it blew up, and it was amazing to me because I was not expecting that at all. It was a completely humbling experience. There were, you know, I had gained a lot of followers, which, you know, is cool and all, but what was even more important and more meaningful to me was that the followers I did have became more engaged with the posts I'd been doing. The engagement rate went from something like 1.5% in the months prior to that December to like over 2%. And so, in other words, out of everyone who would see my post, there was a percentage that of people that did something with it, something like liking or retweeting. And then even a local news organization in the Great Lakes did a story that year about 25 days of fishmas, like researcher creates 25 days of fishmas. So it was one of those kind of spur of the moment things that just ended up catching some attention and catching interest. It was funny, after the first year, I'm like, oh, you know, am I going to do 25 days of fishmas again? I've talked about 25 different fish species in the Great Lakes. You know, I hit on most of the popular ones, things like walleye, lake sturgeon, that first year. And I'm like, I don't really want to repeat things again. So, you know, maybe we'll just consider it lightning in a bottle event, not try and repeat the success and just, you know, call it a day. And I had said that at a meeting I was at. It was the International Association for Great Lakes Research. I had been talking to some researchers and I'm like, yeah, you know, I think one fishmas was enough. And the anguished cries that came out of, no, you can't stop fishmas. I'm like, oh, I won't stop fishmas. So year two, 2017, I came back. I'm like, okay, let's do all new fish species. I'm actually going to plan things out ahead of time. And what was really cool about that second year was not only was I sharing fish facts from the Great Lakes each day, there were other researchers, other fishery science professionals who took the idea and really ran with it. They messaged me beforehand saying, you know, Katie, we saw what you did last year with 25 days of fishmas. Do you mind if we do our own kind of fishmas? And I'm like, no, sure. That's awesome. Like, totally do it. It was so cool to see other researchers sharing fish from their part of the world or their study system that second year. So it was kind of cool. We had the first year, 2016, Katie kind of stumbling into this with the help of the awesome fisheries science community on Twitter who supported me, to 2017, it becoming more of a international and very diverse effort. And then fast forward to the current year, 2018, it's grown even more. We have, I was looking at the different participants the other day. It's something definitely over like 10 different 25 days of fishmases alone, not to mention a couple of people who are now doing 25 days of squidmas for all your cephalopod holiday fun. And I believe there's even a bugmas now. So we've moved beyond aquatic celebrations to, you know, a little more terrestrial based. So it's been so rewarding to see people really like this idea and spread it to make it so that it's more of an open and accessible fun time to just celebrate silly fish and Santa hats. And really, I think that the main goal I had with 25 Days of Fishmas, for me at least, was raising awareness about different Great Lakes fish species. As a PhD student, I obviously spend a lot of time out in the Great Lakes. I get to see lots of really cool fish species all the time, but I realize not a lot of people get to do that. They don't get to be out on a boat catching fish and seeing, you know, what a long-nosed gar looks like in real life. And so for me, doing 25 days of Fishmas is a way of kind of bringing this unseen world to a lot of people, to life, to showing what lies under the surface, maybe just in your backyard. One of the other rewarding things to me, in addition to people taking this idea and running with it, has been bringing together some really diverse groups of people on Twitter to have discussions about the Great Lakes, to have discussions about the environment. One of the stories I always come back to is from the first year of doing Fishmas. There was one day when I talked about the alewife, which is an invasive species in the Great Lakes. And it was fascinating because people were sharing with me like their memories and their stories of when dead alewives would wash up on Great Lakes beaches and these huge mounds of, you know, dead fish. There was someone talking about how they remember their mom taking them to the beach and then seeing this like big rotting pile of fish and remembering the smell so vividly, even though it was something like 40 years later. And then it's those memories that kind of prompt these discussions about, oh, okay, you know, why is the alewife invasive? What is being done? You know, how are the changes in the Great Lakes being seen by people who live and work in the region? And so I think it's that reflection and that discussion amongst not just researchers, not just fisheries science professionals, but some of the people who just live in the Great Lakes and, you know, have an interest in what's in their backyard. They may not have that traditional science background, but they're interested and they want to learn more. And I think that's been really cool to be able to connect some fisheries science professionals with the people who are interested in learning about more.
I'd second that. Not even, I mean, outside of the 25 days of Fishmas, even just doing fish programs for little kids, they all know they're bass and bluegill, but you show them something different, like a gar or
like a darter or something. Yeah.
A little darter or even a smallmouth buffalo, and explain that it's different than the common carp. Yeah. Or explain that the common carp wasn't even native to the United States. And some people, some of the parents' jaws hit the floor. They just had no idea. And you rattle off some of those little facts that you think everyone knows and everyone's just amazed by it. So
right.
You just have to share the information. And a lot of people don't know quite as much as we think they know. So
no, and that's a great point, Nick. It's not about dumbing it down. It's just realizing that as fisheries science professionals, we are like always in it. And so even the things that seem commonplace to us are extraordinary to, you know, a young kid, to an angler who has been fishing a particular river or a lake for, you know, 25 years. But it's not that he doesn't care. It's just that he may not know. And so I think it's what I find about doing science communication is not seeing it as like, I have all the information and I'm telling it to some person or to my audience. It's figuring out what my audience might want to know and like why that matters to them. And then framing my science in a way that helps facilitate that learning and that interest. And, you know, sometimes that means, hey, there's this carp and it's not the Asian carp that you've heard about in the news all the time, but it's still not actually native to the Great Lakes. And so starting a discussion into that. But yeah, it's definitely about figuring out what your audience cares about and what's important to them and framing your message, your science in a way that fits into their worldview.
So then along those lines of how do you pick the fish for each day? Do you still just go in there and wing it? Or I'm sure now you have it set out in a nice little spreadsheet and every fish for each day.
I 100% have a spreadsheet now, which is hilarious. But yeah, the first year, it was just kind of like I had that Wisconsin Sea Grant fish poster, and I was just like, you know what seems like a good fish today? Northern pike. It has definitely evolved beyond that kind of haphazard sampling, as we say. But now I do actually have, like I said, a spreadsheet, and I start preparing for 25 days of Fishmas in like August, which it seems kind of surprising to me even, but it just in terms of the time it takes to first figure out, okay, what species have I not covered yet in the Great Lakes? And then starting to pull together different information, different facts, getting images and videos to use and making sure I, you know, have all my ducks in a row in terms of like, who do I need to reach out to? So like when I feature Gar, I reach out to my friend Solomon David, who is also on Twitter, and be like, hey, Solomon, I'm going to be talking about short-nosed Gar. Just wanted to give you a heads up in case you'd like to do something a little bit like more on that day in the way of Gar. So identifying some of the other fisheries professionals who may have an interest in specific days based on their, you know, stated loves of their study species. So it's kind of, there are a lot of moving parts in terms of figuring everything out. But I feel like, you know, third time's the charm. This year I've got an okay system. There's still a lot of last minute, like, oh my gosh, I need to finish up these tweets now the night before that they need to go out the next morning. But it is a little more structured than just picking a fish randomly off a poster.
So this is your third year of doing it, and you're about halfway through, so you've covered about 60 different fish so far. What have been some of your favorite?
Ooh, Nick, that's an awesome, tough question. I'm going to pick one from each year, because I can't, it's too tough to limit myself otherwise. I would say the first year, I really like doing walleye, and that is kind of a personal one. From where I grew up in Northwest Ohio, I grew up on the Maumee River, which has this really kind of famous walleye fishery. And so I just remember every spring, it was like, oh, we go down to the river, we see all the walleye fishermen doing their thing. The city of Toledo, where I'm from, their hockey team's called the Walleye. So it's kind of that personal connection for me. I also got to share a video of the city of Port Clinton, Ohio, which is on Lake Erie. Each year they do a walleye drop instead of like a ball for New Year's. So that was really fun because it was like a seasonally appropriate fact that I could talk about in terms of, you know, the not just the fish and the ecology side of things, talking about humans, the human connection to that fish species. But at the same point, you know, walleye is a very famous and exciting fish a lot of people knew about already. So some of the ones that were a little less well known were like burbot in 2016, which is always a fun species to talk about. So then for 2017, these are tough, Nick. It's like picking a favorite child. 2017, I have to say, I really enjoyed doing the American eel. So the American eel is kind of interesting in the Great Lakes in that it's just really the eastern part of the Great Lakes, the Lake Ontario, the St. Lawrence. But it's just such a cool fish that I didn't really know much about before I did my research into 25 Days of Fishmas, and me picking eels, part of the reason I love doing this is because I get to learn a lot more about different species that maybe aren't necessarily ones I even encounter all that regularly. And so American eel was definitely a highlight of 2017. And then 2018, oh man, I don't even know if I can do 2018 because I don't want to spoil anything. But I would say the fish that we've talked about so far this year, I'm just like looking at my list here. This is impossible to pick. I'm going to have to say it. Pirate perch. Pirate perch were just a really fun day to talk about because they're just such a cool little fish. And I think everyone loves a fish that has its, basically its butt under its throat. So, you know, it's a very interesting fish. And I think people don't know what a pirate perch is. And so that was a fun day to just, you know, be a little silly and introduce people to a fish that they may have no idea or never even heard of before.
You didn't want to spoil your favorite fish for this year. Do you generally put your favorite fish towards the end of the 25 days, or do you just pick after it happens?
Usually I try and spread it out. I try and spread it so that we have, you know, a good mix of different families of different life histories throughout the month so that we're not kind of doing like, oh, here we do all the Cyprinids at one time. Here we do all the Salmonids at another time. So I try and mix it up a bit to keep people on their toes. But sometimes I do get a little more sentimental and put some of my favorites right around Christmas Day. It's, you know, it's as much a celebration for me as the holiday.
Some of those best presents to open are the ones you got for yourself.
Exactly. And you gotta wait until the big day to unwrap them.
So have there been any fish that you've covered that you were surprised to learn something about when researching the fish facts?
Yes. And I say that with a pause because I think every fish I've really learned something about doing my research for 25 days of Fishmas. Yeah, in fact, I would say that there has not been a fish that I've known everything about. And one of the things that's been even cool is not just the fact I learn about that new fact or new to me fact through my own research, but through what other people contribute on Twitter, what they, you know, someone says, oh, you know, this fish XYZ, they gave me some fact from their own knowledge. And it's like, oh, that's really cool. I never knew that before. And then I get to retweet that to my followers and be like, hey guys, did you know this? Because I didn't. And so I think that goes back to what makes Fishmas great is the sharing aspect and the community participation, is that I'm definitely not the one with all the answers. And I really enjoy when people show new things and lead me down new paths of knowledge that I didn't even know existed before.
So you mentioned earlier that you didn't want to spoil anything, but this episode will go out on December 23rd. Would you mind filling people in on what the fish of the day is for December 23rd?
Ooh, give me a second. I got to check my calendar. You think I would know all these by now. Oh, December 23rd, happy Festivus, everyone. It's time for an airing of grievances about a common introduced species, and actually one, Nick, that you've already mentioned today.
The common carp?
Indeed. Today is the common carp. So we'll be doing our airing of grievances and learning a little bit more about how the common carp got to the United States and some of the knowledge about the common carp, because one of the things that I try and avoid to the best of my ability is not demonizing invasive species, even though they may have harmful effects in their introduced region. You know, common carp are a really cool fish and have really important value, regardless of the fact that they're invasive in the Great Lakes. So I try and strike that balance between, you know, this is a Grinch species in our 25 days of Fishmas. The Grinches are the non-native species to the Great Lakes, but also not making it so that they're really the bad guys. So I'm excited to talk about people with common carp today.
I'm sure you'll talk about it. They're originally brought over for a food fish, and those Europeans over there, they still love fishing for them.
Definitely. And there's actually a really cool fact, and since this won't spoil it for anyone, in the European country of Slovenia, they actually have a Christmas Eve carp tradition in which they bring a live carp home to eat for the holiday season, but keep the carp in a bathtub. And so it's like the Christmas bathtub carp, which I just think is such an adorable idea. But so that's kind of a cool, like, seasonal tie-in that I have with common carp in the Fishmas season.
And when I was trying to figure out how I wanted the Christmas episode to go, I originally was Googling Christmas fish and the Christmas carp came up.
Exactly. It's like such a perfect story. December 23rd was a good day to talk about common carp, not only because of the Festivus airing of grievances tie-in, but because it's getting, you know, close to Christmas Eve and I could talk about that cool Christmas carp bathtub story.
Are you going to have Patrick Cooney weighing in on his Christmas carp bathtub experience?
I didn't know Patrick Cooney had an experience. Now I'm definitely going to have to message him and see if he'll be willing to share that.
I believe he wrote something in the fisheries blog about it. I stumbled across it when I was looking up Christmas fish. So.
See, again, there's so much awesome stuff out there, and I feel like Fishmas allows me just a glimpse of the world and like learning different things about fishery science that, you know, even just as a grad student, I feel like this is all a very, you know, big world, and I'm trying to learn my little piece of it, and making these connections with other researchers is one of the ways that Twitter has been really rewarding to me as a fisheries science student.
Yeah, I've definitely learned a lot through this experience beyond the podcast. I never would have known that anything about remora or any of the other species I've talked about on this podcast. So podcast, Twitter, Facebook, whatever your social media is, there's plenty of information out there for people to learn about.
Definitely. And I think that's the fun part, is we never stop learning. You know, 25 Days of Fishmas is always fun for me because I always get to learn and I get to, you know, help other people learn about fish species.
Well, we've learned a little bit about your past and the history behind the 25 Days of Fishmas. But now the tough part of the interview is over and we're down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple. We kind of asked it earlier, but what is your favorite fish?
Oh. Hmm. Again, like choosing a child. But I'm going to have to say the yellow perch, because that's my kind of focal study species for my dissertation work. But ask me any other day and I'm sure it would be a different fish.
All right. And then what is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
Oh, there's so many. I'd say most of them have to do with being out in the field with my, you know, my field crew, doing the research, getting to spend the summers hanging out around the Great Lakes, jumping into wetlands, sinking into wetlands more so. I don't know if there's a specific memory I have, but just the camaraderie with my team of other grad students, technicians, all of us working towards our goal, and that, you know, getting the data and sampling and really exploring some amazing places.
As we mentioned, you're a PhD candidate, and sometime in the near future, you'll hopefully be finished with that. Do you have an idea what your dream job or dream location to work in would be?
Definitely don't have a dream location, mostly just because, you know, I feel like I would be I'm more flexible towards the job, so I'll go where I can get a job in typical millennial fashion. But I really want to do something where I can link doing research, doing some teaching, more that traditional academic route, with more of this non-traditional SciComm public outreach side. And I don't know if I figured out exactly what that career is called or what that job is. Maybe like a non-traditional academic, or more in the communication side of science is where I see myself leaning right now.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Ooh, that is a fantastic question. I would really like to do, and this is somewhat being done already, but an entire Great Lakes Basin-wide wetlands study. There is a coordinated effort. There's a large Great Lakes monitoring program that I'm involved with, but it focuses on a lot of different components, things like water quality, macroinvertebrates, as looking at them from like an indicator point of view. But I think if I had unlimited money, I'd be like, we're going to do a huge like fish survey of Great Lakes coastal wetlands and really just do a whole blitz. I mean, it would just be like gangbusters. We'd be going around the Great Lakes and having a better idea and keeping a better eye on some of these wetlands to see the changes that are happening in some of the fish communities.
And then if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I would say that science doesn't have to be boring. You know, we get the chance to do some really cool, amazing stuff. And so when we talk about science, we should make that come alive. We need to talk about science in a way that is not dry, is not boring, in order to talk about like why what we do is so important. Because communication is really at the heart of science. As scientists, we communicate our findings to our peers through peer-reviewed articles and presentations. But that sharing of our science needs to also happen beyond the halls of academia and the pages of paywalled journals. And so I would just say, if anything, we need to figure out where our audiences are, what is important to them, and then work on crafting our fishery science messages to them with that in mind, that where they are, who they are, and what is important to them.
All right. And we'll sneak a sixth question in today. a Christmas present for all. What is the problem with bird people?
Oh, man, they're the worst. So the infamous hashtag birds versus fish is kind of a silly dig at the bird people on Twitter, who we have this constant battle between which are better, birds or fish. And I mean, clearly birds are the worst, but you know, sometimes there can be some cool bird things, and I always feel bad if I like want to retweet them. I'm like, am I being a traitor? But it's all in very good fun. A lot of the people who are involved in the birds versus fish battles are very much aware that we're doing this to kind of promote each other's work. And even though birds are terrible and fish are 100% better, there's room on Twitter to celebrate all biodiversity.
Yeah, I think the fish folks really made up some ground with the recent breakthroughs with the birds are fake conspiracy.
Absolutely. People are finally catching on. Been saying it for years.
Yep, it's almost mainstream knowledge now.
Exactly.
Well, Katie, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you, the work you're doing, and the 25 days of Fishmas and the history behind all that.
Well, thank you, Nick, so much for having me. I mean, this is awesome what you're doing with the podcast and getting to showcase some really cool voices in fishery science and have them tell their stories. So thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you very much. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Best way would be through Twitter at Dr. Catfish, DrKatFish, or through my email, which is koreill2@nd.edu.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. Listen in next week when I talk to Dr. Ray Hilborn from the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 18th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, science doesn't have to be boring. And Merry Fishmas to all.